The Round with Richard Kaufman.
Over the next 10 weeks, you'll get an insight into the world of golf and what it takes to be a top-level sportsman and woman. This is The Round with myself, Richard Kaufman. If you've heard me before, it's commentating on golf tournaments around the world. I wanted an avenue that could bring you closer to some of the stories I feel should have the chance to be told. Every interview begins with The Round, the most important or significant in the player's career, chosen by the golfer themselves. But it's much more than that. They'll tell us how they got there and the journey after.
Sunday, April 17th, 2016.
First up, it's Andrew Johnston, one of the most popular personalities in the game of golf. But only his mum and a few members of his family still call him Andrew. To his friends and those who watch him and shout his name, it's Beef. Beef has chosen the final round of, well, to give it its full title, the Real Club Valderrama Open de España, hosted by the Sergio Foundation. To you and me, the Spanish Open. This, though, wasn't Beef's first time to Valderrama.
Going to that golf course, I was excited to go and play it. I remember going there with England boys, and they took us on a tour around the course, and we got to drive around it. And I remember just, driving around the course thinking, this is amazing. And so to go back and play there was special anyway.
So when you get there that week, you've had a pretty good start to the 2016 season. So how are you feeling about your game?
Not very good. I went over to America to see my sister in Florida and that, and obviously took my clubs to play. And we had such a busy start to the season. I think I played 7 events in the 7 weeks. And then went out to Florida, and I just felt a bit like burnt out already in some weird kind of way. So I didn't actually play practice that much. And I got to Valderrama, and I played 9 holes on, I think it was the Monday or the Tuesday. And I was like, oh my God, I'm going to shoot 80 round here comfortably. I wasn't swinging it well, but luckily Tomo, my coach, was over. So we could kind of battle through my swing and try and get me back on track, get me in some shape for the tournament.
So when you're teeing up on a Thursday, knowing that your game's out of kilt and that you're not where you want to be, how do you get into the mental space you need to be to try and win a golf tournament? Or are you at that stage just thinking, let's just put a number on the board?
Yeah, it was strange. They changed the Pro-Am up. So they did 9-hole Pro-Am for that. So I remember playing 9 holes in the morning on the Wednesday, and then I went and practiced in the afternoon. I was hitting balls and I just couldn't get it like right. And I said to him, I've had enough now. I said, I'm just going to go back and like build up from my wedges and just work on what we're trying to work on and just go from there. So I turned up on the range on Thursday and it was like one of the things, just built it up and started hitting a few sort of chip shots, 10, 15 yard chip shots. And I was like, that feels a bit better, and sort of built it up through the bag and I started to hit it a bit better on the range. So I went out there with sort of no expectancy and that, just to go and play the golf course and go and do my best. And it wasn't like going into the tournament thinking, oh, I'm playing great, I've got a good chance here. But then it wasn't kind of like, oh my God, I'm playing terrible, because the range session and warm-up was good. So it was a bit of a funny situation. I remember it was a lovely day on that Thursday, no wind, good weather, and I had a good day on the Thursday.
And you had a good day on the Friday. By the halfway stage, you and Pablo Larrazabal, the only players under par. You must hear the chatter in the locker room. There's a lot of players that go to that golf course that are kind of beaten before they start. Do you pick up on that?
People say comments and mention it, and I think like it works both ways. I've heard players say something about a golf course, and then you look at the leaderboard and they're up there on the leaderboard. So try not to listen to too much and just go and do my own thing. And that, because I think if you start listening to everyone, it sort of doesn't affect you, but it sort of starts putting things in your head that you don't need to hear. Regardless if you like the course or not, you just got to go and play yourself and work it out for yourself.
Golfers like to moan, don't they?
100%.
It calls you a party.
No, I still moan about stuff. Don't worry about that.
But meanwhile, it's going good. So from turning up to not feeling it, to halfway being right there in a chance to win the golf tournament. So at this stage now, halfway stage, heading into the weekend, are you now feeling that this could be the week?
No, I try not to think that far ahead. I mean, Friday was a tough day. It was, the wind picked up, and I remember it was the 16th hole on the Thursday, I hit driver wedge in, and on Friday I hit driver 3-iron in, and it was so windy and difficult, and Saturday was exactly the same. So it was just a matter of Saturday just trying to grind out some sort of a score and not put yourself out of contention. That was all that was really going through my head.
So come Saturday night, Mike Lorenzo Vera is leading. You're in with a chance. Where are you here now? Because I understand, right, you had quite a nice vibe going on off the course. You had some friends and family.
Yeah, my girlfriend was there, and then my caddy's good friend was there, and Louise's cousin was there, and their family. So it was good. We were going out to dinner every night with everyone and that. So it was really relaxing off the course.
So your focus isn't then just golf, 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 because I take it they don't want to just talk about golf.
No, exactly. Louise's cousin's husband is Spurs fan as well. So we were having good banter and stuff off the course and going, eating some nice food and that. So it was really relaxing off the course. So, and I think that really kind of helped sort of just take my mind off it.
You mentioned there at the weekend you're not thinking about the winning. Are you now Saturday night within touching distance of the lead thinking about a possible win?
Yeah, definitely. It was one of them thoughts that was running through my head was, come on, we'll get another good day. If you can hit the ball well for another good day. I was putting well, chipping and putting well. So I was like, come on, if I could turn up and have a similar feeling to the last few days, why not?
So at the start of that round, Lorenzo Vera, who's leading, has a poor start. Your start wasn't the best. Is that fair?
Yeah. I remember the first hole was in the middle of the fairway, and I tried to hit sort of a three-quarter shot, and I pulled it long, and then I had a tough chip shot. And I remember missed the putt coming up, and I think I made bogey on the first. And then I remember making par down the second, and I didn't hit a good shot on the third. I hit a bad iron shot on the third right. And I was trying to work out in my head why I was hitting it right and what we were working on the week. And I made a good up and down on the third, and I hit a tee shot left on four. And I was still trying to figure it out, and I was like, right, just sort of nudge my weight a little bit more into my left side and that, so I can get the path a lot better. I got lucky with the tee shot, I had a swing, I had a shot, so I was trying to just lay it up, and I said, well, let's give it a go, and I just made that adjustment, and I hit one just straight out the middle, and I was like, oh, like, that feels a lot better, like, let's stick to that.
So that was that kind of the moment in the round that gave you the platform for the victory?
Definitely, because then we hit wedge shot in, and I cannot remember, I think I made par, I think, on the fourth.
Yeah, you did, yeah.
And I said, okay, so now we got a tricky tee shot. It's only a 3-iron off the next, but obviously you can't hit it right. You want to be putting it on that fairway because five's not, it's not a nice hole. I hit lovely 3-iron off the tee. I was like, that's good. And nice wedge shot in, got onto six. And it was a tough pin position there. I remember that. It was so difficult to get it close because you don't want to go past the pin. So I said, oh, I'm going to take the 9-iron, I think it was, and like hit it hard. And if it gets up there, it doesn't. If not, it's going to be at the front of the green. And you know, you two putt and get off with a three, and I just flushed the 9-iron, and that's when I really thought, like, right, just keep doing it now, because I'm hitting it great, I'm putting well, let's just go and, like, be aggressive.
And you did that next hole, seventh, you hit a great approach in to make birdie.
Yeah, definitely, hit a lovely shot there, had a good yardage, and yeah, it's one of them shots where I can't believe how quick the ball stopped as well. From a 6-iron, I thought it was going to be maybe sort of 10 foot, and when I got up and it was a tap in, it was like a nice feeling, like almost like a relief feeling, sort of start getting on the right track and start making birdies.
So now I don't know how aware you are of the leaderboard, but now you're there, you're at the summit, you're in a share of the lead with Jos Lauten at the turn, then James Morrison joins the party, Sergio, who's the tournament host that week, he also ends up at one point in a four-way tie with you. Are you aware of that? Because you're saying before about ignoring the talk that's going on. Are you also ignoring what's going on around you golf-wise and focusing on yourself?
I wasn't aware until the 11th green. They had a big scoreboard up on the 11th green. I wasn't aware till then, and I looked, and I think I was one shot behind at that point. And I knew, okay, if we can play the last seven holes well here, like, we have a good chance.
And so there you go. You're up there. The game, as you say, is right where you want it to be. And then you're three putt 14. Are you thinking positively, like, come on, turn this around, your game's there, or are you thinking, why on earth did I just do that?
A bit of both. I hit a really bad shot into 14 in the first place. Left myself a tricky putt across the tier and it breaks so much. And I kind of walked off the green thinking, like, oh, if you've gone and just, like, wasted a shot there. But we got up on the tee and my caddy said, just give yourself four birdie putts coming in. That's the goal. Just give yourself four birdie putts and we'll see what happens. And that, and it kind of thought, okay, all right. And it kind of took my mind off, like, scoring wise. It was just like, hit the green, hit the fairway, hit the green. And that was the kind of thinking I went into the last four. Holding the putt on 16, and there was a big roar from the crowd. And then I kind of, like, all of a sudden, the adrenaline really kicked in. And I was like, it's close here. And that's the first time I really felt, like, the big adrenaline rush. So, yeah, after holding that putt, I think, like, walking to 17, seeing the leaderboard, I think I realised that I was, yeah, one ahead at that point. And the whole big adrenaline rush came. And 17 is an amazing hole. It is. It's a horrible hole. It is. And I knew straight away where the pin was going to be, front left, right near the water. And, I mean, you can putt it in the water from 20 foot if you're not careful. And I remember hitting the drive just a touch left and walking up to it and seeing that it was okay, but sort of the edge of the tree was sort of, it wasn't in my way, but it was just sort of blocking my perception. And I looked at it and I said, like, what yardage have we got? And I think it was about 180 to the pin, 185 to the pin. And I looked at it and I was like, I said to Gordon at the time, I was like, I think it's a six, but I said, I want to hit a 5-iron here. I said, I don't want to be leaving a 100-yard, 80-yard wedge in here because it's so difficult to control the spin. You spin it back off the wall or it can take one bounce and hop over down the back of the green. So I was like, I'd rather be over the back of green in two. And I just flushed the 5-iron, absolutely flushed it, adrenaline. I thought it was going to be on the green still and I just saw it disappear. But that's what I was kind of playing for, in a way, is to get over that side. And so when I walked down and saw where my ball was, in practice, I'd hit a few putts up the slope. And I really did not like putting it. It was so steep. And then the change of going from the fringe to the green was just, I really did not like it. So I just pulled my wedge out, 58 wedge.
That's a scary shot, though, because you could leave it back at your feet, and as you've mentioned, the water on the other side of the flag. There's a lot of potential there to go wrong, but you're feeling confident about this shot.
I felt more confident with the wedge in my hand than I did with the putter, because to go up that steep and then to go back over the slope and it breaking a lot, I mean, I just found it easier to chip it. I knew I could take the first bit out, it'd take a couple bounces and sort of just trickle out. So I knew I could take the hardest bit out that's making the chip shot so difficult. I could take the worst bit out of it by chipping it. And I thought, well, if I don't hit it, I don't hit it. It might be 15 foot and it's not the end of the world. And that, but I hit a nice chip shot there.
Yeah, to say the least. Yeah, it was a great shot. I know you didn't make the putt, but it was a great chip shot. So you're coming down the last now and it's within your grasp. But, we've talked about the iconic 17. It's not like 18's a picnic, is it?
It is no picnic. That tee shot is a nightmare.
And you're leading now by one.
Yeah.
Coming down the last.
Yeah.
Never won before on the European Tour. How focused are you?
I was all right. I got through the last, like, three holes wanting to do. So it was almost just a matter of just to keep doing it. The tee shot on 18 is just nasty tee shot. You know, you can't really hit driver off there. You got to get it down the left. So I always felt like three wood was the kind of right club, because if I hit it a bit left, it still should kind of carry the trees and you'll still have a shot. And if I hit it a bit right, you still have room to maybe sort of fade one round the corner. So I stuck with that all week. And when I hit the tee shot, I hit it a bit out of the hill. It wasn't flushed. And I had no idea that it'd sort of gone through the tree at the time until I spoke to my friends here who were watching it.
So they're all watching back home. You have no idea, but they know more than you.
Yeah, they had no
idea. A couple of thousand miles away.
I walked straight up and I was like, it's perfect, middle of the fairway. Didn't have a clue that it got sort of like through the tree, because, I mean, it could have hit and gone anywhere.
You need a bit of luck, but you know, yeah. You gave yourself the platform, you got the luck, and now you're in perfect position off the tee. So now it really is within grasp. You kind of done, I mean, I'm not saying that it's a walkover from there, but you've crossed the biggest hurdle.
Yeah, definitely. I know Yas was behind me playing. So still I knew it was only a shot and he could make birdie. I didn't know what he'd made on 17 either. And I remember it being a good number for a 7-iron. It was about 170 yards. But there was a bit of wind there off the right. And when I hit it, I thought this is absolutely perfect. I thought it was going to be maybe 10, 20 foot at the time. And it come off on the front edge of the green. And I was a bit confused to how it was so short. So I was like, oh, okay, that's all right. You know, if you miss it left, it's not pretty. So I was like, all right, it's not too bad. I had a putt sort of straight up the green. So I wasn't too fussed about that. But obviously, it's still difficult to gain the pace from your first putt just off the green. I had a walk up. I remember walking up. I was thinking, this got to break a little bit. And I hit it. I hit a good putt where I wanted to. And it just didn't break. It kind of went really straight. And that just about, I don't know, about 3-4 foot. And I was like, here we go. That's the last thing you want. It's like 3-4 footer. And I remember walking around the hole and having a look at it. And I was quite unsure if it was going to break or not. It kind of just looked a bit funny. And I said to myself, I stopped doubting yourself. I said, just hit this straight dead center. Like, there ain't going to be much break in this. Just hit it dead center. And I just tried to concentrate, line my ball up and that. And I said to myself, it's lying dead center of the hole. So just hit it. Like that, so you've got to do something spectacular to miss kind of thing. I was kind of sort of bluffing myself like that. And
it's amazing the conversations you're having with yourself within this little bubble of trying to win a golf tournament with all the eyes on you. But that's so important, isn't it? That's the mental side of the game that, you know, people always talk about. You're fighting the demons almost.
Constantly. Like with golf, there's so much time to think. It's not like other sports like football and stuff where it comes as instinct a lot of the time. So with golf, you're waiting there and you know what's coming. You know what shot you've got coming up. And that if you're waiting for people to play, and that I remember waiting for James and Ross to finish, and that I'm standing there. So it's taking a couple minutes looking at the putt and stuff. So things going on in your head. And it's almost, I always find that you've got to get out of your comfort, like you just got to get out away from all your thoughts, and that's the best place to be in. It's sort of just to not really kind of think about what's going on.
But you are this situation.
But you are, yeah. But you're trying to battle that.
Understandably, though, I mean, this is now potentially a career-changing moment for you. So it's inevitable you're going to have some demons to battle. But you won the battle.
Yeah, I won that battle. And I remember knocking the putt in and sort of people cheered, and I didn't really celebrate because I knew Yas was behind. So I just wanted to get off, mark my card, and then just kind of wait, because obviously you're thinking he's going to make birdie down there. You always got to think the worst.
Yeah, and then what do you look like? You've celebrated a win, he makes birdie, and suddenly you're in a playoff.
Exactly, yeah.
So you're off to the scorer's tent now.
Off the scorer's tent, I remember, so a lot of people were cheering, celebrating, they're happy, and I kind of just try to just walk straight in there and concentrate on signing my card. And then obviously, we could watch it. We could watch it on the screen and just sit in there. And I think that was the worst part.
And then Louise was there, wasn't she, your girlfriend? Yeah. So you're sitting there now watching Jos Lauten. So now you're a TV spectator, pretty much. And, you know, you don't want to wish any ill on anyone, but inside you must be thinking, please don't make birdie.
Yeah, well, it was funny. He hit a similar tee shot. And he's come through the tree, remember, and it's on the fairway. And I was like, oh, he's going to make birdie here. And he hit it in the bunker, and I was still like, he's going to hold this bunker shot. And he's just sitting there thinking, oh, he's just going to hold it. And you just have him visioning the ball going in the hole, and you're just like, oh my God. Like that. And obviously, when he hit it and missed, like the whole kind of feeling of relief was just like insane.
And the emotions got to you, didn't they?
Oh, definitely, yeah. Definitely, you dream about it as a kid and that watching people win everywhere and on telly and stuff, and to kind of put yourself in that position and to win a tournament it's just mad. It's just crazy kind of feeling.
How much of that can you remember? Is it a blur, or can you remember it second by second?
I remember it quite well. We had to go straight outside and do an interview with Sky, and that's where I said one of my first sort of comments, you know, because they're asking you, like, what are you going to do now? And I just wanted to get home. I just instantly wanted to get home, and that's exactly what I wanted to do. I just wanted to go home, see my mum, see my brother and that, and go up here to the golf club and just get absolutely hammered. That's exactly what I wanted to do.
And that's what you said?
Yeah.
You said, I'm going to go home. Can't wait to get back here where we are right now, North Medic 6 Golf Club, get hammered and see my mum and brother and spend some time and celebrate. And that quote kind of encapsulated how you are. It could have been taken the wrong way, I suppose, but people loved you for that, didn't they?
Yeah, like, I didn't even realise that it was that much of a big thing with what I said at the time. I was just speaking truth. I wasn't really thinking about anything. And yeah, and like, when people said, like, when I went over to play the US Open at Oakmont, and I can't think what player it was, and they said they played it out, like, it was all over TV, that comment, everywhere. And I was kind of shocked by it, because I was like, you win a tournament, you want to go and celebrate. Everyone does it, even if they say it or they don't say it. Everyone goes and celebrates after. So I didn't think it was a big deal.
You say that. I recently spoke to someone, I won't mention her name, but she won a major in 2017. And I went up and said, like, congratulations on your win. And she looked at me and I thought, have I got the wrong player here? Because she looked at me like, what win? And then it turned out it was the right player. I said, did you celebrate and do it? No, nothing. And this was a major she'd won, first time. I think I've given it away now. Can you understand that?
No. That's, how?
Nothing.
Like, you've worked that hard and put yourself in a position to win a major and you haven't celebrated your achievement. I mean, that's a massive achievement.
Yeah, you think that's what it's about.
And that it happens, like, you think it'd happen every day life, you know, if someone goes and gets a big promotion, it's a similar kind of thing. You know, if someone pulls off a really big deal for their company, whatnot, they go out and celebrate.
It would be alien to you, wouldn't it, to have that attitude?
I couldn't do it.
No.
I couldn't do it.
So, what you did do is you went back to North Middlesex Golf Club and you got hammered and you had a great party.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, when I come back and I spoke to all the boys and they were like, we should have a Spanish party. And could do a fancy dress, and I'm like, I'm off, whatever. So yeah, so that's exactly what we did, and I was struggling to find a costume. I was like, I know the boys are going to come as this and that. I was like, I need something different. Louise found the piñata suit, and I was just like, I can't wear this. And I was just like, no, you know what? No one's going to go as a piñata. I'm going to wear it. And it was, I mean, it was just a really kind of surreal night.
What was more fun, holding that putt and then waiting and then finding out you'd won the tournament, or being at the golf course where you'd grown up as a kid and celebrating that victory? What moment do you think will stick with you more?
Oh, probably being here.
Yeah, I thought that would be your answer.
Yeah, because you're kind of so in the zone at the time and there's so much adrenaline. It was like you can come back and you're relaxed and stuff, and it felt like then I could actually celebrate. It just feels like I couldn't celebrate over in Spain because I wasn't with all my friends and family and that. And I really, really wanted to get home that night, but I couldn't. We had a flight booked Monday morning, and I remember, like, that evening we were going to go out, and after we did all the media stuff after, it takes ages, you know, it took like 2 hours to do, which I had no idea. I come back and everyone was drinking, my manager, caddy, and that friends were all drinking champagne in the clubhouse. We had a few bottles and I said, what are we going to do tonight? And I was just like, you know what? Let's just go and get some dinner. And that, I just want to go back to the hotel, pack, get home. And that, because I knew the big party was going to be here.
Saving yourself up.
Yeah, definite.
No, but it was great. I mean, I saw some of the pictures. It looks like you had a great time and you really enjoyed the celebration. When you then go on to your next golf tournament, do you feel different now that you're a European Tour winner when you're teeing it up next?
Not in terms of golfer, like as myself, but things are different around you. Things change around. And I think Morocco was the next one I played, and now you're in like the TV groups all the time.
Didn't in the pro-am, didn't you have to?
I played with, yeah, the prince.
Yeah, his Royal Highness, shall we call him, in Morocco. So suddenly you're meeting royalty and having to play golf with royalty. And it's a little different probably to what happened when you were playing in the pro-am in Spain, where Sergio, I assume, was the centre of attention.
Yeah, definitely. And that's the kind of the changes that happen. And that not necessarily the way you feel about your game or playing golf, but... And then being, having that centre of attention is totally different.
Yeah, when we I ask everyone I sit down with the round, it's a personal choice. And we've chosen Spain, and I can understand why. It was your first win on the European Tour, hopefully of more to come. But I wondered whether it might be a round that came a few months later at the Open Championship at Royal Troon, because in a way, from the outside looking in, and you can verify it or you can say that's nonsense, that's really, for me, where it changed, where Andrew Johnston turned into beef and beef mania really took off.
Yeah, definitely. It was playing US Open. It started a bit there on the weekend.
So you qualified for the US Open in June. The victory at the Spanish Opens in April. You then qualified for the US Open in June. So you're saying that you saw the start of it there?
It was kind of strange because it turned up and all of a sudden, again, it was like a lot of attention and that a lot more people, autographs and signed stuff and people shouting out a bit more. And I was kind of surprised by that there. And I thought, oh, maybe it's just like a one-off kind of crazy week kind of thing. And like, people shouting out. And like, especially I remember on the Saturday, because of the delays, we played two rounds on the Saturday and the afternoon, like people shouting stands and like a lot of people shouting beef and stuff. And I was thinking like, this is crazy. But I just thought it was kind of like a one-off, like strange kind of thing. And then going to the Open, the first 2 days, there was a bit more like attention again, but nothing too crazy. On the Thursday or Friday, you know, I just got on with my golf, played my golf. And then being in one of the final groups with Sergio on the Saturday was just, that was the day where it kind of went just mad. That was the day that it went like, just blew up.
Put this in your headspace here. When you're saying that, I mean, we can hear what the crowd shouting. I mean, is there anything specific you can pinpoint?
All that week, strange things was happening. And that someone sent a message and from Sky and stuff saying, Butch wants to meet you. Like, I mean, Butch, I'm like, what? Why does he want to meet me? Like that and stuff. And I was like, oh, I've definitely got to go and do that. And I think I met him on a Friday after playing and stuff and went over. And I was just like, that's kind of like crazy. Obviously, knowing Butch and who he's obviously worked with and stuff. He's a legend.
Absolutely. So that was a kind of pinch me moment that
he
wants to meet me. And then you're in the third round playing with Sergio.
Yeah, so the third round playing with Sergio, and I can't have a good day. Put myself up again in the second last group, and I remember did a few interviews for BBC Five Live, and my social media, my Twitter, Instagram, I mean, would just go berserk. I think it went from something like 10,000 or 8,000 followers to like 60 something. In the space of 2 days.
And I know you respond, and you like to for a reason, I know that, because you don't want to feel like anyone's left out. You want to respond to people that get in touch with you as well. I've often messaged you, said, don't come back to me, I just want to tell you this, and you still come back to me. So, I mean, that must have been pretty all-consuming as well.
I couldn't respond. They would come, like, I'd put my phone down for a minute, and I'd pick it up, and I'd have 200 new notifications. I couldn't do anything. I honestly couldn't reply to anyone because they were coming in so far. There was no way I could keep track.
By the time you replied, there was another 10.
It was just, it was just mad. And I remember we had a house for the week and I was sitting there with my mum, sister, niece, and one of my good friends we were all staying in the house and stuff. So we were like, we're going to get dinner or whatever. And it was the same kind of thing in Spain where it was kind of relaxed. you know, go and get some food and just chill out. And yeah, that Saturday was just mad. And going into Sunday, I kind of knew what to expect from Saturday. Because I remember when you walk from the putting green to the first tee, you walk under the stand, no one knows when you're coming. When you pop out, then they all start shouting like beef and stuff like this. And I was just like, this is just madness. Like,
and how well did you start in that? I mean, what, three birdies, first four holes? I mean, it went crazy.
I remember the first hole so clear. I can't remember what I hit off the tee, but I was on a fairway and I didn't hit a good wedge shot in. But I was just inside Bill Haar's ball and we're on a similar line. And I was looking at the putt and I was thinking, is it going to break much at the end? And I watched him hit his putt and it didn't break that much, if I remember right. So I was like, all right, I've got the line. And then I was like, this guy's going to go mad. And I just hit a good putt, it's gone in. And I just remember, like, I don't think I've heard a cheer as loud as that ever on a golf course.
Because, you know, the final group, we know the story with Stenson and Mickelson and how amazing with the golf they were playing in the group behind you. So you were trying to make inroads into their lead with the hope, I assume, that you never know that the claret jug could come your way.
Definitely, yeah. When I got off to a good start and I was on the sixth hole, I looked and I was like even further behind them. And I was just like, no one's catching them. Like, no one. And that was when the point was like, you ain't going to win it. Like, you just knew, because I thought I got off to a good start and my start looked average compared to what they did. And it was just one of the things, it's like, oh, man.
I know, but for you personally, let me take you to one moment, because I remember this clearly now. As we've said, people are going crazy. Par 3, 14th, you chip in for birdie and your mum Jackie's there, greenside, isn't it? And I remember I'm commentating and I'm doing stuff as well. And there was a look there saying, and I don't know, was she crying or something? Because it all, you know, when we're commentating, we're supposed to show emotion. Yeah. I felt myself welling up for you and your family. I mean, I felt the pride. Goodness knows what she and you were feeling.
Yeah, it was funny. Like, my sister, like, obviously it's so hard to pick people out. There's so many people.
Sure.
And it just so happened that I walked off the side of the green and my sister kind of half, like, didn't shout, but I was close. And she said, look what you done, you made mum cry. And I turned around and I was like, I've got to turn and look the other way. I had to go and face the other way. I couldn't look. I had to ignore it.
Otherwise you would have been...
Yeah, yeah.
You'd have gone.
Yeah, I had to look the other way.
But that must, I mean, looking back on these kind of things, that's, as you say, you want to celebrate with your friends, your family and stuff. That you know, that's what it's about, isn't it? You know, making your mum feel like that. Obviously, you don't want to make her cry, but it was a cry of being so proud.
Making her cry for right reasons.
Yeah.
And that I'm probably still a few behind on right and wrong reasons.
But it was a magical moment for you personally, chipping in like that, the crowd going berserk. I know at that point you saying, you know, and realistically, you couldn't win the championship anymore, but to perform in the penultimate group in the final round of a major and produce that kind of golf, that must have been so special.
It was, yeah. It gave me, again, like, Spain gave me a lot of confidence, and that did as well, because obviously it's British Open and you know how big the field is and you have the world's best players there. And it gives you confidence knowing that, you know, if I play good golf and that I can compete with them.
At this point, I want to kind of go back a little bit, because, you know, we're talking about your family there and, you know, and how much they mean. And I hope you don't mind, you know, want to talk about your dad and, you know, what he did for you. Because growing up, we're here in North Middlesex Golf Club, which, if people don't know, it's in a nice, lovely part of North London where you grew up. It's a lovely golf club, very down to earth, kind of fits in with the kind of person you are. How did you end up with a golf club in your hand? Was your dad a player?
Yeah, he used to play, so when I was like 3-4 years old, we used to go over to like just over to fields or pitch and putt. Yeah, he used to just go and whack a load of golf balls, and obviously he used to play and stuff, so then yeah, he used to take me with him. And now I'm my brother and my sister, we all used to play a bit.
So your dad, Noel, he was I think he worked for a timber company.
Yeah.
Drove a bus as well.
Yeah, he started... Yeah, what I remember, he was on the buses and then he moved over to a timber company and then kind of worked his way up Timber Company.
And your mum was a dinner lady.
Still is.
She still is. Still,
yeah. Same school, yeah. Just round the corner from here.
She must love it. She still does it.
Yeah, yeah.
Great. So, I mean, it was just, you know, inverted commas, normal upbringing.
Yeah, that was the thing. Just normal, you know. Yeah. Nothing fancy, nothing bad. Just normal. Yeah, normal upbringing.
But it wasn't just golf you loved, you loved all sports.
Loved all sports. I tried to play everything, wanted to play everything, and I still do.
How's your basketball now?
Terrible. I think the last time I threw a basketball was in Turkey last year with my caddy Will. And he just couldn't stop laughing at me because I was so bad. And I was like, what do you expect? So I gave it the whole, well, you're American, I'm not.
Yeah, because, I mean, he's American, but you do love all the American sports. Where did that come from?
My brother's really into basketball. So watching it with him, I really got hooked on it. We went to a game years ago now in Miami. I think it was, I must have been 17, 18 at the time, maybe 18 at the time. And that, and when we went to a Miami Heat game, and I just loved it. It just fascinates me. All sports kind of fascinate me, how good people get at what they do. And that, so I just watch it as a sheer kind of inspiration. And it's just, we're lucky to be able to watch people do something at that level. And that, and I just love watching it. Anything, you know, it could be absolutely anything, any sport. And that, like, darts, for instance, how good they are at darts. How good, like, basketball, cricket.
Do you ever watch golf in your time off?
No, not really.
No.
No. If one of my friends is doing well, I'll watch it because I want them to do well. It's like Eddie was doing well in Qatar and things like that. You know, I keep an eye on it because I want to see my friends do well.
Eddie, Tommy, yourself, we're all in the same year group playing together for England boys. I mean, that's, you know, Eddie Pepperell, Tommy Fleetwood we're talking about. I mean, that's a pretty good core of a setup at that point.
We had an amazing team. Matt Nixon was in the team as well.
He plays on the European tour, yeah.
Garrick Porteous.
Yeah, he was an amateur champion.
Yeah. Matt Haynes as well, played on tour. He's good, he was a very good player as well. So, I mean, there was loads of us. There was actually, like, that team was just so good.
But you didn't necessarily enjoy that experience of being an England junior.
I loved playing the tournaments and representing my country. I absolutely loved it. But I didn't like the training behind it. I've always been, I guess, a bit different and like to do things my own way. And then all of a sudden sort of getting told, you got to do this, you got to do that. I just used to argue with the coaches a bit. But it's funny enough, though, because the few coaches I got on well with back then, now I'm working with Tomo, who was one of the England coaches when I was there. And I've been up to see Paul Ashwell, who's putting coach as well, and he was there as well.
Yeah, because they can't all be doing something bad, because, you know, it's Chris Paisley, Matt Wallace, Tyrrell Hatton, Matt Fitzpatrick, Andy Sullivan, Chris Wood. I mean, the list. The guys around your era, I mean, have had amazing careers. So they must have been doing something right.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, they're great coaches and the setup's really good. But it just didn't fit me. And that, but I've always been like that. I've always been like, wanted to just go and do my own thing. And that, and if I don't like something, I'll kind of, it's obvious.
Is it that you don't like someone telling you what to do? Or you think you know better?
I just disagree with some of the principles and stuff like that, what they wanted to do and at the time, and I didn't want to do it. So it's a bit of both. And that I still wanted to learn and improve and get better, but you know, I do things in my own speed. I mean, I am slow at literally everything. I can't rush anything. I watch like someone pack golf bag, it'll take them 10 minutes, it'll take me half an hour. And that, because I just sort of faff around putting things in and checking stuff, and I'm never in a rush. And like, even when we're at a golf tournament, Tom was like, ready to hit balls. I was like, give me another like 5 minutes, give me 10 minutes. I'm just gonna finish my cup of tea like that. And I'm always one just to sort of just do everything. It's so slow.
So in a way, this game suits you because we know it's a slow game.
Yeah.
But you are now your own boss. I mean, that must be a great feeling, because as you say, you can do what you think is right, and that's, I assume, where you wanted to be.
Yeah, definitely. Over the last sort of 10 years, it's great to be your own boss, but it's also good to get a kick up the bum as well at the same time from someone, and to have that, because it's so easy just to sort of drift off and sort of not work hard enough. I find that as well. I'm a person that I can spend all day practicing. I can spend all day sitting on the sofa. So I need sort of a few people around me to give me a kick up the bum as well.
We're going off on all sorts of tangents here, but is that kind of what happened for you then in 2017?
You know, doing well at Open and that, and then decided to go over and do the web.com events and try and get a PJ Tour card and stuff like that. And I went, got my card, and it was, the buzz was just crazy. And I was thinking, like, sometimes, you're asked to do like TV shows and stuff. I asked to go on Chelsea Handler show, and she's like so big in the States. And I'm like, why does she want me to go on there, kind of thing? It was like that. And I was like, yeah, I'll do it. Like, I'll be up for a laugh and stuff like that. And you say, yeah. I want to do it. And all of a sudden, you're like, oh my God, 3 weeks has gone. It just disappeared. And that, I haven't had any rest. I haven't practiced enough. And then you're cramming stuff in and everything feels like last minute. And I turn up to tournaments thinking I was prepared, but in the back of my head, I knew I wasn't. And it was like the distractions just got the better of me. And turn up, and I play all right in a few events and stuff, and I come off and I'd be disappointed, because I was just like, this is not how I know I can play. And it was a really frustrating year in that respect. It was like, yeah, every tournament felt really hard work. Like, I had to grind. Everything was a grind. And when I got home, end of the year, I sort of like had to think about it and stuff, and I was like, I did too much. I didn't concentrate on golf enough. I did too much.
It's easy, you can look back at that now, but I mean, with the chances and the opportunities coming your way, it's hard to say no, isn't it?
It's so hard to say no. So hard.
Because you're getting to meet some of your heroes, some of the people that you look up to and idolise.
Yeah, you get a chance to meet people you've seen on telly, or like, yeah, people you've watched for years, and you're like, yeah, I want to do it, and but it has an effect. It has a knock-on effect that I didn't realise it was happening, and it probably started from after the Open all the way through to nearly end of the season 2017, and you don't realise it's happening at the time. And I remember playing a few tournaments like Open last year, and I played with Adam Scott on the Saturday, and I played awful. I mean, I chipped and putted for fun, but I didn't play well. I was really uncomfortable on the course. You stand up to holes and hitting drive off the tee, and you're not comfortable and hitting shots in, and like everything felt on edge.
Compared to how you were on the Saturday the year before as well.
Exactly, yeah. Where I felt great that Saturday, come on, let's go and play. There, I was like really hesitant and that, and I was like, why is that? And it's like deep down, subconscious knows that I haven't hit enough balls, I haven't practiced enough. If you know you've practiced hard, then it doesn't really matter if you have a bad day, because you've gone, well, I've tried hard. But if you go and have a bad day and then it's like, well, it's because I haven't practiced enough, it's a horrible feeling.
So is this just a part of growing up, being a bit more mature? Because it is hard to say no, not only because they're wonderful opportunities, because I know you don't want to let people down as well. That's your personality. People wonder, is Beef like, is he like that off the golf course? Well, you are. You don't want, there's that, isn't there? That's that conscious within you that's like, don't want to let them down. But you've got to, haven't you?
Definitely. Yeah, you have to say no at some point. And I wouldn't say it's part of growing up. It's just experience, isn't it? It's just learning from your experience. And when, as a kid, or even as like being 20 years old, and someone says, oh, you're playing with him, he's had 10 years on tour and that, and you come off and they say, oh, it's experience, it's the difference. I didn't really understand it. And now I totally get it. And I've learned from the last sort of 18 months what you have to do, because no matter what tour, wherever you play, there's so many good golfers there, and you can't get away with slacking off.
Is there one thing that you think, oh, I'm glad I did do that?
Yeah, there's a few things.
Come on.
we had a blast last year at the cricket. I get on well with Stuart Broad, and that he said, if you want to come to cricket, let me know. So he sorted out tickets for Oval Test match.
Who were England playing?
They were playing... We went twice. They were playing West Indies once. It's South Africa. Okay. Yeah. It was South Africa. They played South Africa. And I mean, you turn up and it was free booze off day. And that. And I mean, there was four of us who went. And I mean, we ended up in the Oval. We're the only people left in the Oval. All the cricketers have gone home. We're still upstairs. And like, it's like experiences like that. And then we went to Lords and we did it at Lords. I ended up in the change room at Lords with all the players and stuff, like after they beat West Indies and stuff like that. And it's just like, you know, they're great fun, and doing days like that, just, yeah, real good fun. But yeah, you have to say no at some point, because I've got to get on with my golf. And like, while that's a great experience, I'd much rather shoot 6 under on a golf course.
Just on England West Indies, is there part of you that wants the West Indies to do pretty well too?
Yeah, I have to split Test match England and the one day is West Indies. I have to split it.
Because we should explain, you're part Jamaican.
Yeah.
Yeah. So on your dad's side?
Yeah, on my dad's side.
And I remember talking to you a few years ago about this, and you hadn't been to Jamaica at that point. You've been there now, haven't you?
Yeah, went to Jamaica a couple of years ago. Went and met an uncle I'd never met before.
Have you got a lot of family out there?
Yeah, loads. I mean, the Jamaicans, big family.
So you could actually represent Jamaica, couldn't you, at the Olympics if you wanted to?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I should have done the relay.
No, I mean at golf.
Yeah, I know.
Come on.
Yeah, I could do it at the Olympics, yeah.
You could?
Yeah.
But then that might hamper any Ryder Cup chances.
Yeah, exactly. It's a tough one, because I'd like to, in a way, I've thought about representing Jamaica before, because I feel like I could maybe make a really good impact on golf in Jamaica as well. But obviously I want to play Ryder Cup at the same time. So I've got to work out a better way to get Jamaica golf going and play Ryder Cup, if that makes sense.
Is there any kind of golf scene in Jamaica?
Funny enough, I got a message on Instagram from like Jamaica Golf Association saying they have a tournament in December. Will you come and play? So I need to look into it and find out. Because if I can, and we can get, you know, we can get more Jamaican golfers and stuff, and more people from there playing, that'd be amazing.
Yeah, it's an interesting side of you, because if you look at your personality and stuff, you can understand when you look at you and how you are, you know, even with your beard and the beef head, that, you know, there is that Jamaican side in you. Because obviously the colour of your skin doesn't necessarily give it away.
No, we said it was funny with the beard. Obviously, nothing really grows here on my chin. Louise, like, winded me up for years about it. Said, why does nothing grow here the last couple of years and that? And I said, because I'm Jamaican. I said, because I'm black, like this. And she's like, no, it's not. So I can't remember exactly what we were watching, but there was a black fella on TV and that, and he had exactly the same beard. And I paused it, and I was like, look at that. I said, now look at this. And she was like, oh, my God, you're right. And then if you look at a lot of black people, they don't get hair here for some reason.
Oh, I'll have a look. I hadn't noticed it. But
yeah, you'll notice it now. You'll be watching TV and you'll see a black fella with a beard and you have no hair there.
Louise didn't want the beard, does she? Well, she didn't, at least.
She doesn't mind it. She doesn't mind it.
At first, though.
At first. And then she changes, like, when are you going to get rid of it? Or, I can't wait till you get rid of it. And I was like, I like it at the moment, so I'm going to keep it.
Because not everyone was that... I mean, there have been, as much as all the positivity and the love you've had, there are guys that, or people, shall I say, that want to throw negative stuff at you. And one of those things was about your beard.
Yeah, definitely. After winning Spain, I was actually going to get rid of the beard. After winning, I said it when we were playing a few holes in practice. And a few people said, oh, your beard's a bad image for golf, blah, 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 like that. I said, I'll keep it now.
That's it.
Yeah, I'll keep it.
And goes back to not being one to be told what to do.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. What does it matter what you look like? I'll keep it. And then be stubborn about it.
When did you know you wanted to be a golfer?
Probably when I was about 14, 15. Yeah, just watching it on telly, realised playing as a kid and stuff, and it was probably the sport I most enjoyed playing. And that, and I liked the fact that, you know, it just comes down to you.
So you're 14, 15. How good a player are you at this point?
Nothing special. I think I was probably off low single figures then. Like, nothing really special. I didn't really think about it too much. But obviously growing up, watching Mickelson Tiger and stuff like that, and you want to be playing with them. And then that was the kind of thing. And then getting an England set up and seeing that and having a few decent results here and there. It was strange. You always feel like, yeah, I want to be on tour, I want to play and stuff. But then it seemed so far away at that time.
We've mentioned already, you know, you had a normal upbringing, you know, no extremes either way. And then you're 17 years of old and you're hit by a thunderbolt when your dad suddenly died. I mean, that must have been a pretty traumatic experience for you.
It was difficult because, you know, we're going, getting taken to tournaments and stuff like that. So I always had my dad to rely on. And then all of a sudden it goes. And then I was a bit like, well, what do I do now? I was like, what do I do?
He had a brain tumor, didn't he?
Yeah.
I mean, you didn't have long to really digest the
No, it was about 6 weeks, I think, if I'm right.
I mean, that must have been, you know, for a 17-year-old boy, any boy, as you said, though, but the guy that, you know, put the golf club in your hand and, you know, took you to all the tournaments and had held your hand along the way, literally, sometimes, that must have been so hard to deal with.
Yeah, it's just a sense of, like, just feeling lost. And I was working a bit here in the pro shop, and then I was like working with a member who was a builder. I used to help him out for a bit of money and stuff. And I was like, at one point, I was like, I don't know if I'm going to play again. I was like, honestly, I was at 17. And I was just like, I don't know. And I didn't pick up a club for 4 or 5 months. And I was just like, I don't know if I want to do it or not.
What made you pick up a golf club again then?
People, a few members here dragging me out. Come and play. I remember I played one time and I was just like, whatever, I don't really care about playing. I was just like, oh, I think I nearly walked in after 10 holes. And then, oh, come and play. And like, that kind of get me going. And after sort of, you know, everyone says, like, it just takes time. And then after a bit of time, my mum and sister were really good and helped me out. And it's like, if you play, like, we'll take you to the events and stuff. And I was like, okay, I'll carry on.
You carried on, though, I assume, with a pretty heavy heart for a while. Maybe you still carry it with you now, I don't know.
Yeah, definitely. You have, like, you always have memories and stuff like that. And you always have good days, some days you have bad days. But as you said, as time goes on, you learn to deal with it better, manage it better, which is more, it's just an experience again. Yeah, I remember, like, almost like a sense of he's watching down, you've got nothing to really worry about kind of feeling. I kind of try and take that into golf and that. And it's like, if I don't play well, it's not that bad.
And you've set up the Noel Johnson Foundation. Just explain what that is.
He used to help the juniors here, help run the juniors here. And when he was helping out and like running the juniors, we had a really good junior team here. We had we've had two guys who played some European tour, another two that have done their PGA and coaching out of this small golf club. And I just want to get more, well, we haven't got any juniors here at the moment and stuff, and it's just gone through like a real bad patch. And the idea was to start getting juniors back, and ideally, I like to get it bigger so it's not just golf, it's in every sport. Because I was always lucky enough to play any sport as a kid and try it. And then kids don't know what they're good at if you don't try it. If it gets them off the streets and that, if it helps them socially, and that, I think sport has such a big effect on people.
I'm sure your dad, and I know your mum is obviously, but your dad would have been proud of you doing that and everything you've done. But it's fair to say there's another guy, sort of an elder statesman in your life, that's played a big part in where you're at as well, because obviously losing the father you had at 17, you were fortunate that a father figure then came into your life as well.
Yeah, definitely. Member up here said, oh, maybe we should go and play golf with a fella up at Porter's Park Golf Club. And that, and I was like, okay, I'll go and play. Turned up and had a good knock. And he said, what are you going to do? I said, I don't know. I was like, I don't know if I'll play golf or not. And he was like, I think you should carry on playing. And I was just like, we'll see what happens. And that, but I said, I need to go and earn some money, make some money. And he was like, well, he was like, I'll help you out, like financially. And I was in the men's squad, one of the men's England squads, and I really wasn't enjoying it. And he turned around and he was just like, maybe you should try and turn pro.
This is Sean.
Yeah. He was like, maybe you should turn pro. And he was like, why not? He was like, just start and play the Jamaica events, maybe like try and get Euro Pro, see how you do. If not, at least you're giving it a go. If it goes well, then carry on. And that, and I kind of said to myself, all right, I'll give myself a couple years. And the first year, won a Jamaica event, and then had a couple where I finishes Euro Pro and stuff. And then all of a sudden it got into 2011. I got a couple Challenge Tour invites. I went to Q School, missed out on second stage in Spain, got a couple starts Challenge Tour, and one of them I finished third. And then all of a sudden I was like, hang on a minute, I can do this. But if it wasn't for him, I wouldn't be playing golf. There's not a chance I'd be playing golf. Yeah, Sean was the one who said, like, no, turn pro, give it a go. I still dip in and out. There's no doubt about it. Still dipping out when I'm like, I absolutely love the game. And there's times where I'm just like, oh, whatever.
Didn't you go for a job interview?
Yeah.
Got offered a job.
Yeah. Yeah, working in the city. I have no idea what it was for. I turned up and it was like no training. It was like, right, London Bridge, all the big city banking firms, whatever they do. And
so how did you get this job then? How did they give it to you?
I just turned up and had an interview and they said, what have you done in the past? I said, oh, I was a golfer and that. And she was like, oh, okay, blah, blah, blah. I had a good chat. I saw the other people for a job interview. One geezer turned up in like jeans and a t-shirt and stuff, and I was like dressed smart, and I was like, he's got no chance. I was like, he's got no chance like this. Yeah, so I went for about 6 job interviews that day, and I was sitting in Starbucks, and she called me back and said, we were like, you come in for a week. And I kind of sat there, and then I was like, I'll call you back. And I had to think about it, and I was just like, no, I'm gonna carry on playing golf. And it was like that decision where it was like, what am I gonna do?
You obviously chose golf, and you obviously then went on that crazy 2011 run that got you.
Yeah, it was almost like
your card for the European Tour.
It's almost like a sense of, again, freedom. Because obviously playing golf from a young age, I always have that feeling it's like, I can't do anything else. And that, so it's like you're almost forced to play golf. That's the feeling. So when I went for joining with you and I said I could have got this job, and then I kind of made the decision that I was going to play golf, it was like a sense of freedom.
So instead of Andrew Johnston, the City High Flyer, we have Beef, the international golf star. That interview could easily have doubled in time. I didn't get the chance, for example, to go into detail about how Beef went from almost losing his Challenge Tour status in 2013 to becoming number one on that tour the following year. And while last year saw another slight downturn, it's clear Beef knows what's required. His rededication since the turn of the year already looks to be paying off. He's played some excellent golf already and came so close to making it win number two on the European Tour at the Indian Open, where he lost in a playoff. Behind the beard and behind the smile and the lovable personality, there's clearly a determined and single-minded golfer. Next week on The Round, we turn the clock back to 1976 with the then reigning European Tour number one, Del Hayes, taking down South Africa's greatest golfer, Gary Player.
I think the point of it was that I hit 11 fairways in 2 rounds, the final 2 rounds, and I shot 66-66. Gary Player stood up in his speech and he said, I have never seen anybody play worse golf and win a tournament.
And Dell tells us how South African politics played its part in seeing him turn his back on the professional game before he reached 30.
Thank you for listening to The Round with Richard Kaufman. You can follow us and get in touch via Twitter at The Round Podcast, on Instagram, Podcast The Round, and on Facebook, At The Round Richard Kaufman. And we'd appreciate you taking the time to rate and review us on iTunes. The Round Podcast with Richard Kaufman, in association with IMG Audio.